Having money or not having money hasn't changed anything in my life. That hasn't surprised me. That's the way I am. And be ready to accept failure. It's just part of life.
You are a driven international professional or manager, have achieved quite a bit already, but are asking yourself from time to time, what do I really want? How do I want to work and live? Then this is your podcast. I'm Gina Friedrich, career and life coach for people who want to actively shape their future. Every second Thursday, I release interviews for you with inspiring, successful, as well as renowned international personalities from the world of business, NGO, and sports. They all will share with you what these questions mean to them, how they handled obstacles in their lives, and shaped their journey to where they are today. You are curious and don't want to miss anything? Sign up for this podcast right here. And now, let yourself be inspired on your very personal journey towards the future that you wish for. Hello to this episode with the title of Having Money or Not Having Money Hasn't Changed Anything in My Life. This episode will give you some special insights into the life of the 72-year-old inventor Morris Ostrow, who was born in Germany with his parents being survivors of the Holocaust, raised in Israel, moved to Canada, and calls Japan his home now since decades. Morris is a studied engineer, was a top judo player of the Canadian national team, who also succeeded in the Jewish Olympics in Israel. Hear how he decided to not follow in his father's shoes, joining and one day taking over his successful factory. Morris also shares how he started working as an engineer and the situation when his dream of being part of the International Olympic Games came to a sudden end. Why he describes being employed, feeling like being a slave, how he decided to quit, as well as what it meant to him having his former wife giving up on him and his inventions. You'll hear how he failed many, many times, but never gave up, until he really was able to celebrate huge successes, giving him the freedom he wanted. Get ready for some very nice stories and his personal impulse to people who are still not sure if and how they should go ahead with an idea. And here he is. Welcome, dear Morris, to this podcast. I am very excited having the time to speak with you today.
And I'm likewise very excited too.
It's funny because we met actually more coincidentally, but still I believe that there are no coincidences in life. And I'm very thankful that you actually just said yes and that we're sitting here now in Tokyo Midtown in the middle of green trees and some birds that we hopefully will hear in a moment as well. And here in Tokyo, we had a little chat already that made me curious and even inspired me on a couple of ends. And I thought I will share this as much as you're going to share with us now, dear Morris. If I would, just to give our audience a bit of impression who you are, in terms of like really as a person, if I would ask your closest friend who Morris is, what would he or she tell us?
I talk too much. Well, I have a lot of friends. I love people. I love sharing things with people. And from all over the world, all nationalities. And it's a pleasure that there's so many different kinds of people in the world. And every day I wake up and I say, it's time to go to war. I'm joking, of course. But I try to live my life to the fullest every day and try to enjoy it. That's maybe what people would say about me.
What a nice thing to hear or to imagine others saying about you. And when we had our chat, you were mentioning just like straight away that you're an inventor, that there are so many things that you do, but the core is kind of being an inventor. And I'm just curious, maybe you can tell us how it all started, how you actually followed your path to do all these things, these different professions that you do today.
That's a good question. And the answer is that I think I've always been an inventor. I was born an inventor. Since a little kid, maybe because my parents were poor when I was young, I had no babysitter and no toys to play with. So I had to create my own toys from finding things in the garbage and just making toys out of them. And that's what started it, I think. And I wasn't a good student. I was maybe one of the worst students in my class. I was in Israel at the time. I was born in Germany, Bayreuth, Germany. My parents were Holocaust survivors. I was born 1948, and we went to Israel in 1949 because the State of Israel was born in 1948. And I was there till the age of 12. And at the age of 12, we went to Canada. My parents decided to go to Canada, where my father became very successful. And he wanted me to follow his, he had a factory and so on and so forth. And I said, no, life is too short. I want to live my life and enjoy my life. So I became an engineer. As I said, I started being an inventor. For inventors, it's good to have an engineering background. And I love being an engineer. And also, I was involved in sports, so I became one of the top judo players in Canada. And at the age of 25, I graduated. I had my black belt. I was on the Canadian national team. And they have a Jewish Olympics in Israel. So they chose me to go to Israel. And I was very happy to be back in Israel because I still had my childhood friends there in a little town called Ra'anana. And I participated in the Jewish Olympics. I got a silver medal, which I'm very proud of. But my big dream was to go to the big Olympics. And here I am in Tokyo, Japan in 2020. I live 5 minutes away from the opening stadium of the Japan Olympics. And they canceled that because of the coronavirus. You know, here we are. What can I say? Life is like a very famous Indian guru. He used to say, life is not a puzzle to be solved. It's a mystery to be lived. And here we are living it, right? I decided at a very early age that I don't want to just, you know, move into my father's factory and be the next big boss in the factory, that this is my life and I should live my life. And yes, money is important, but it's not the most important thing in my life. I got a job in the nuclear research department in Israel, and it was a great job, but I still had the big dream of being in the big Olympics in 1973, which is way before most of you listening to this podcast were born. So after 2 years of working at this wonderful job, I quit my job and I came to Japan soon thereafter. And I did judo for over a year. I got injured. There went my big dream. End of story. And then I had to make a living. How do you make money? So I did a lot of things. But the thing that I want to talk mostly about is my inventor part of my life. I always realized that if you can come up with one invention that could make a lot of money, then why waste your whole life working for a company? Why become a slave to any corporation or any organization? Even when I was working for the Technion in Israel in the nuclear research, I felt I had a fantastic body because I was in judo and I was a great athlete. And here I am, this great athlete, sitting on a chair in the Technion and thinking to myself that my job, excuse me for saying this, is worse than being a prostitute. Not only physically was I bound to be here, but I had to think about creating this machine. So they were controlling my body and my mind. So I decided, what actually made me quit is one day I was sitting at my desk. I did a great job. They loved me. And I loved my job too. One day I'm sitting there at my desk and I see this little ant crawling on my desk. And I thought to myself, how lucky the ant is. It was born with everything pre-programmed. It knew everything it needed to exist through its life. No studying, no reading all these books. If I spend my whole life trying to read all the books around me, I wouldn't be able to finish. There's so much knowledge. So I said, it's time to quit.
So you, we were just talking a few minutes and there's so much in it and I have so many questions in my head. I'm sorry, I had to. We are just using one microphone, which makes it a bit difficult. Sorry for pulling it away. But maybe really going a couple of steps back, you've mentioned that your father was actually inviting you to join his successful business, to be part of that business, to come back to Canada. And I was just wondering, and before when we were talking, you said that you just have mentioned that you had your own dreams, but still I can imagine that that was not an easy situation to be in, if you have your dad who's actually living his dream, wanting his son, his only son, to be part of it. How did you feel, and how did you deal with this feeling of saying no to him?
So my father was devastated when I told him that I'm very sorry. I have no plans of joining his company or getting into his business. My life was too precious, and my freedom was too important. And I truly respect him for being able to do what he did with no education, no university or anything, because it was interrupted because of the war. He couldn't go to school. And yet he came to a new country, Canada, and managed to make a real success for us. We lived in a gorgeous house. We all had cars, whatever we wanted, we had. But I had no plan to continue his dream. Now, I started all kinds of crazy businesses, because I remembered one man told me a long time ago, if you work for a company, you work for the company all your life, you end up with a pension, it's very secure, everything is good, but at the end of the road, you probably won't end up with a lot of money. And money, let's face it, is freedom. Money is freedom. So, and I don't want to be a slave to a company. So I decided to try different things, and I did many, many things, and some made money and some didn't make money, but I have my freedom. I can go to work when I want. I don't go when I don't want. Now, one of the things that I love to do is I'm an inventor, so I've always invented things which I like to invent. In the beginning, I invented high-tech stuff because I'm an engineer and I can do that stuff. I can invent elevator systems, for example. To mention elevator systems, the one I invented was when I stayed in my father's place in Toronto. He lived in this very expensive high-rise apartment. And the problem with that is every morning when you want to take the elevator to go to work, you have to wait because a lot of people, there's rush hour. I decided, wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to wait for the elevator? So I invented an elevator where you had a little control unit inside your unit, and you set a timer, like for how many seconds from now you want to use the elevator, and then you push the request button so you can get the fastest service possible without waiting in the hallway. And I thought it was a great invention, but tried to convince Otis and Westinghouse and Mitsubishi to buy your invention. Very difficult. They didn't buy it. And I made a lot of those things. And it's hard to go to a company and convince the president or whatever that you would really change the quality of the service that's available now. So I failed and failed and failed, spent years inventing this high-tech ideas and constantly failed. And what I want to share in this podcast is what made it possible for me to become financially successful. And what I did, one day I'm going to Marunouchi to work in this place in Tokyo, which is the high-tech industry people. Everybody walks around in a necktie. And I decided on the way, I used to ride my bicycle there, and 35 years ago, nobody rode a bicycle. It wasn't very popular, but I did, in a necktie and a suit, and I'd work only twice a week because for a company, Mitsubishi-related company, I didn't want to sacrifice my whole life for a company because then you cannot really have the energy to invent anything. So I worked twice a week for 8 years for a patent office, and they paid me very well. For the twice a week, and I decided I'm not going to invent anything high-tech. I'm going to invent something very stupid that's very easy to make, and let's try to make some money with that. And that's exactly what I did.
May I just ask a question here? Because I'm just wondering where you get this power or this positive energy from when you experience one fail, let's call it fail, you use that word, after the other. I mean, that really requires some energy to get out of that hole or get out of the situation, especially when experiencing that a couple of times after each other. So what helped you to again and again get on both feet and try again?
I would say partly stubborn, partly stupid, and it's just my nature. Now, I'm not the first one to be like this. I think Edison tried like 1,000 light bulbs before he got the right material that didn't burn up. And it's just the nature of being an inventor. Now, having said that, there's a Japanese proverb that in Japanese goes like this, "Ano shippai wa seiko no moto." Now, what that means in English is failure is the road to success. And I think that is wrong. The right proverb should be failure and failure and failure and more failure and more failure is the road to success. Okay. So there you go. And that's the way it is. Nothing works the first time. You have to keep trying again and again and again. So I keep trying, and then eventually I came up with a stupid idea, and that became a worldwide success. Why? Until today, I don't know why people wanted to buy that stupid thing I invented. And what it is, just to share it with you, because I'm sure you're all dying to know, is I took two pieces of plastic, transparent plastic. I made a frame out of them. The size was A4 size. And I put some dyed silica sand in there with some other types of sand with different specific gravities. And put some water in. And I closed it up. And I called it a sand picture. And what it does is when you turn it over, the sand falls down in the water, makes beautiful little mountains. And people fell in love with that. Why? I don't have a clue. And that made a lot of money. It became a worldwide hit. And ever since then, I went on to in the next and the next and the next. And now I make bicycle pumps. Why? Because I love bicycles. I always did. And my pump is the world's lightest bicycle air pump, and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, congrats. That's amazing. And it's funny for me now seeing you smile while you share all this, because you guys cannot see him. And I think it's amazing and a huge success. And I was, I was still wondering in the end if these moments happened and you still managed to start over again. And you mentioned this proverb and you realized that it needs failure and failure. But still, I could imagine that at a certain point in time, you feel like giving up. You feel like, you know what, maybe even doubting that this is the right path for you. So how did you handle these phases when you actually really felt like, wow, this is getting tough and I actually am not so sure anymore if this is the right thing to do?
That's a very good question. Everything great. Keep going. Keep going.
So he knows everyone.
That's a whole story in itself. Used to work for me. Anyway, moving forward, you become very doubtful at some point. But what's the alternative? To give up is not a very nice alternative. Not a very nice alternative. And I used to tell my second wife, now I have my third wife, my second wife, when she totally gave up on me. And she said some very nasty things to me about my patents and inventions. Because I took her back to Canada and she saw how my father lives, my mother live, and the opulence of their lifestyle. And then we come back to Japan. And I live in this little apartment. And she told me at one point that she's totally given up on me. And one night she said that I asked her, what's more important, love or money? And she said money. And when she saw, unfortunately, I brought one of those sand pictures home and she saw it. And the thing she said about that is, who is going to buy that shit? And when you have no money and you're totally out, totally down, it's not really what you want to hear. And it's very hard to keep yourself motivated. And I think one of her most brilliant, she's Japanese, not a native speaker, one of the most brilliant poetic things she ever said is that my patents are worth less than toilet paper. Because toilet paper, at least you can wipe your ass with. But my patents are totally useless. And 3 weeks later, that piece of shit became a super success. So how do I motivate myself? What's the alternative? You have to believe in yourself. And I used to tell my ex-wife, if being poor was a crime, then 99.9% of the people in the world would be in jail. It's not a crime. Not everybody has to be rich. Enjoy what you have. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Yeah, and it always, so first of all, thanks for sharing that so openly, but it all always defines on how you define success, right? What does it actually mean to be successful? And everyone might have a super different definition of that. So what is yours?
Enjoying every day, having a lot of friends. I'm 72 years old and I have an 8-year-old daughter and she just cracks me up, It's my one and only daughter, and I think from what I just said, you can understand why I didn't have a daughter earlier. But my life is just simple things. I'm vegetarian. How many tomatoes can I eat in a day? Having money is freedom. I don't have to work for anyone. I don't have to worry about my next salary. And that is freedom. Now, I don't live in a gorgeous, super big apartment, but it's good enough. I don't have a car. I have a bicycle. It's great. And most of my friends, rich, poor, I have the whole spectrum. They're my friends, not because of how much money they have. It's because they're interesting and positive people. And I love positive people. And that's my life. Every day that goes by is gone forever. Can't get it back anymore. Just enjoy the simple things in life. That's what I do every day.
Yeah, and we choose. We have the power to make the most out of it and decide on what actually is the next step and which is the path that we want to follow. And Maurice, if you would be looking back now at many, many years, and you were also explaining, and also before this official part of the podcast, you were mentioning that you had like ups and downs, and you went from not being successful to really, making it a big success. I can imagine that there were a couple of decisions that you had to take, and maybe there's like the most difficult one that you could share with us, which that was and how you actually take such decisions.
Well, the major change in my life, I decided to change my direction from high-tech to low-tech. That made a big difference. I'm in total control of my life right now. I invent what I want, but the things that I invent, I can manufacture myself. And the best invention is yet to come. I keep inventing. I love inventing. I love it. I get a big kick out of it. And if you can make some money out of it, it's also good. Now, I hope I answered your question. And what were the major role-changing decisions in my life? That was one of them. Now, I've invented many things before that, and some did really well. And it's wonderful that suddenly all this money comes pouring down on you. It's just a nice feeling. It's kind of a reward for your efforts.
Yeah, and you deserve it after everything that you've put into bringing all these ideas to life and also really focusing on making it your own ideas that you actually work on. How did people around you, close friends, family and so on, react when you had these moments of taking the decision to not focus on the high-tech part anymore, like the high-tech industry, or also to leave the position of being employed to start your own thing? So what were reactions of close people around you and how did you deal with them?
My friends in general, I have wonderful friends and it's great. It's just wonderful. They accept me for what I am. They like my energy. And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
And they never told you like, Maurice, this is crazy. You shouldn't do it. Because if I think about my life and how many times I decided to take a turn, even really like going back from like a high, well-paid project lead position to university, for example, somehow need, with the need to make money. Besides that, having a more difficult life, I had people, I even had my dad telling me that this is crazy and how will you manage this, and you're so used to this and that. And he had all these pictures of me in his head, and I proved him wrong. But I had people around me telling me that this might not be the right thing, and also later leaving the business world, going to the NGO world, where they said you will never be able to get back, and imagine all the money that you make now, and so on. So like more these not very empowering comments. I mean, there were just a few. It's not like everyone reacted like that. But did you also have people around you, yeah, kind of maybe not so much believing in the path that you decided to take?
Great question. I get that all the time. And I've been getting it forever. And it reminds me of one conversation I had at that company, the patent office. One individual that was working, very smart, they were all smart people working there, called me into a meeting room and he said to me, "Morris, we're about the same age." And he was a Japanese guy. He graduated from Tokyo University, engineering, blah, blah, blah. "How come, since I graduated, I worked for all these different things that in Israel and in Japan, I did all these crazy things. And he, since he graduated, all he did was work for this one company. What makes us so different?" I told him in a very simple way, "The difference between us is that you are too afraid to leave the company. You're too afraid to start your own thing. Why? Because you have a wife and kids, you have a mortgage, and you have all these bills that you gotta pay, and you have a certain lifestyle, certain standard of lifestyle, and you're not willing to sacrifice it. I can live in a shoebox. I don't have to be successful. But my freedom is too precious to sacrifice for any amount of money. It's just too precious. That's my life, and it's always been this way. And thank whatever, for I had a few lucky breaks. I can sit here forever. I never have to work again. And it's a nice feeling. It's a very nice feeling."
Yeah, wow. And I was actually smiling when you said that you could live in a shoebox. I remember when I decided to stop my well-paid job in the media industry, going back to university, working like 2 days a week to somehow make a living in addition to the savings I had. And that for me, it was also like, sometimes I think I had like 3 or 4 days in a row I had potato salad with sausage. And yeah, it was possible because I knew what I was doing it for. So there was something driving me, and I was sure that I can make it, and I can make it for myself and not to prove others wrong. So making sure, yeah, you're following yourself when doing all this, and that you're able to access your like an internal compass that you have to make sure and to be connected well enough to yourself to just know when it's right and when it's worth fighting for it and when it's worth, yeah, surviving phases that are not so easy. And you have done that many, many times in your life. I can assume that. Also with what you've just shared, it gave a good impression of that. Could you say how the decisions that you had to take, how you do that generally? Is it like more like following your gut feel, or how do you actually come to a conclusion when it's about taking a difficult decision?
Usually I follow my gut feeling, and I just keep inventing things that I really like. I've made some mistakes in my life. For example, one mistake was investing in a place called Arizona. I lost $1 million. As I said earlier, you know, I don't judge people by how rich or poor they are. I enjoy people for what they are. And I remember that I saw an ad in the Japan real estate window that said, no pets and no foreigners. And that really upset me. I'm very sensitive when it comes to racism. And I started my company and I changed the whole system. And that's why I got myself in trouble with the tax man, because they didn't like what I was doing. I really simplified the whole rental system in Japan. Me, nobody, this little cockroach, you know, made a difference.
Stop saying that.
Yeah, but it's true. And what I want to say is I changed that system by starting a much more just system. I used to invent in a park called Yoyogi Park. I used to go there because I didn't have...
We are there almost every day.
one day I made this. I used to go to Marunouchi on a bicycle, and sometimes it would rain and my jacket would get wet from the... I wouldn't ride in the rain, but at night when I'd go home, it would rain in the day and the water would splash from the back of my wheel onto my jacket. It's very hard to wash a suit jacket. So what I did was I invented a bicycle mudguard that you actually pull out from the bottom of your saddle. So it doesn't look nice for high-end bicycles to have a mudguard. So I would pull it out in a rainy day and push it back in when it wasn't raining, and that prevented my jacket from getting dirty. And I remember I tried to sell it because I had no money. And I called up saddle manufacturers trying to sell the patent, the invention. And I found one Osaka company called Kashimax. And I called up the owner, and he came to Tokyo going to see Bridgestone. And I tried to explain to him what this mudguard, how it clicks on and how it works. And he never rode a bicycle because he inherited this saddle company from his grandfather. He has a very nice car probably, but no bicycle. He doesn't know how to ride a bicycle. And here I am trying to explain it to him. He didn't understand it. So finally he had to go to Mitch, you know, his company's in Osaka, and he went to see a company in Tokyo called Bridgestone. And on the way to Bridgestone, I gave him that mudguard. And he didn't understand, so I finally gave it to him. I gave up on him. And then he opened his attaché case, and there were four brand new saddles that he manufactures. I said, "Oh, here." I just clicked it on one of his saddles, and he went totally berserk. Because, "How am I going to get that thing off now?" He closed his thing, and he told me he will call me that night. I said, "Here we go again, going to call me. Of course, he's going to forget about me." Night, I came home from my jog, and the phone is ringing and ringing and ringing. I pick up the phone, and there's a lady, and she says, Morrison, Mr. Morris. And I say, "Yeah." And, "Oh, my boss wants to talk to you." And they, "Oh, Morrison, this is Kashima. I mean, call me Ted. I want to be your best friend." And I'm thinking, Ted wants to be my best friend, the guy from this morning. I say, "Hi, Mr. Kashimax, how are you doing? Listen, can we meet right away?" What happened is he went to Bridgestone, he opened up his attaché case, I can imagine this, and they saw the mudguard, they fell in love with it, they signed a contract for 10,000 pieces or whatever, and he doesn't even have the license for the patent yet. What's he going to do now? He's got to get me to sign a piece of paper. So, sure enough, we met, you know, a week later, we signed the papers and everything. He was very happy. He gave me, you know, advance money and royalty money and this and that. And it was great. And then the next time, after I signed the documents, we were in a place called Shibuya. And that's very close to where I live, which very close to the park that I like to go to. And I said, "Mr. Kashimax, would you like to see my office?" And he said, "Yeah, of course, you know, we had pizza, he paid for it, wow." And we go, we walk, and he's telling me he just bought a brand new car. And I said, "I thought you had no money." He said, no, you know, "I got a great deal." Because he squeezed me, of course, for the royalty and everything. It was okay, he bought the patent. I was very happy, because I had zero money at the time. So we go to the park, and I sit down at the bench, and he starts walking around it nervously, and finally he says, "Aren't we going to your office?" And I said, "This is my office." He said, "This is your office?" I say, "Yeah, the bench is my office. Rent is great. The scenery is great. I bring my laptop computer here. I had the first AnySeq laptop, which was four lines, you know, 20 pages is full memory, you know, it's a long time ago." And he couldn't believe it. He sat down across from me, and he was quiet for maybe 10 minutes, didn't say a word. He said, "Morris," finally, when he spoke, "I want to be your best friend." Yeah, and end of story.
So I can imagine that was quite impressive and something that he probably did not expect. But how cool that, I mean, I met you on a bench. Yeah, I met you really enjoying nature and just being there, being present, and also the way we started talking. I think this is something that makes you special, and you kept this until today, which is great. Yeah. Maurice, if you would now, these days, meet a person who is like kind of having an idea in mind, but not really sure if it's something that should be brought to life, that is worth investing time and money on, and maybe there's not even money, as you've just said. What is something that you would recommend someone who has an idea, but still not there yet in regards to really taking the next step and starting an own business or bringing this idea to life?
Now, one thing that I would really like to mention on this podcast, something great has, since the internet, the two major things that have changed in my lifetime is the cell phone that you carry in your pocket and the internet. They are major life-changing inventions, devices that we have today. And one of the things that is now available on the internet, which is fantastic, is that people like us that like to invent things and don't have very much money, there's a website that's called Kickstarter.com. And Kickstarter.com has really made it possible for people that have no money but have a great idea to make literally millions of dollars. And it's not you give away your business or you sell your business. Kickstarter is basically a way to kickstart your idea. Factories require a minimum to agree to manufacture your product. And you need $10,000. So if you could collect, one product would cost, let's say, $50. So you need like 200 customers to get the $10,000 or whatever. If you could collect 200 people, then there would be enough money to make your dream come true, which is fantastic.
I can imagine, compared to back then when you had to start, or when you were starting, this of course is a completely different setup that the world has created there now. I think it's like crowdfunding, right?
Yeah,
probably.
Crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm. And in regards to the way approaching such a moment of deciding to start your own business, like really more in regards to a mindset, is there also something that you could share with the audience where maybe one or the other person is considering starting their own business? What is something that you could actually share in regards to a learning that impacted the way you look at things or that made a difference in approaching such a phase?
You just have to believe in yourself. And a lot of friends, probably your wife, I hate to be so negative, will say, no, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And most people just trade the freedom for security. And you just have to believe in yourself. Many friends will say, nah, for whatever reasons, maybe because they really believe it's not going to work, maybe because they've tried many things and they've failed themselves. It's very easy to criticize. So you just have to believe yourself.
Yeah, and maybe even adding to that, that a couple of people are just answering or reacting like this because they never had the guts to try it themselves, right? Because they never tried, and they make this a reason why others also might not succeed in it. So this could also be a reason, and I experienced that myself as well. So, so many insights and stories that you have shared with us now. And looking back at many, many decades of very diverse experiences and successes, what surprised you the most?
That having money or not having money hasn't changed anything in my life. That hasn't surprised me. That's the way I am. And be ready to accept failure. It's just part of life. And just keep trying and trying. And the most important thing, I feel, is if you don't love what you do, then don't do it. Every day that you lose in your life is gone forever. And I'm not prepared for that. I just love life too much to do that.
What an amazing statement to close an amazing interview. And I can only see that you do exactly that. And it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much, Maurice, for the time that you've shared with us.
My pleasure. And I have to say that the interviewer, Gina, has the same feelings about life. She's a wonderful lady. And it's a pleasure to talk to you and to meet you. And I'm happy I've met you. And, of course, your husband. And I just, I'm jealous of how much they love each other. I have to say that.
Wow, I have a super red hat now, I think. That is the first time that I have to deal with that now. Let me see if I can, how I can cut that out. No, thank you very much. That were very kind words. And yeah, it's also different that you have met my husband and me now here in a private setting. So that's why you're mentioning him. And we were super lucky having had the chance. And now we are happy that we will have some lunch together and spend some more time with you. Looking forward. And Morris, thank you very much again for being with us here today.
A pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's interview, I'm more than happy if you would sign up for my podcast on your individual podcast player or Spotify, Apple, Android or Google Podcast, Deezer or TuneIn. I hope to have you here with me again soon. Warm regards from Düsseldorf in Germany.